Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Dr. Lisanda Bomela, who is an orthopedic spine surgeon with a practice in Johannesburg. She specializes in surgical and non-surgical spheres concerning the health of the spine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dr. Amelia.
Dr. Bomela, to start with, please, can you tell us about typical conditions that a spine surgeon treats?
Thank you for that question. It's actually quite diverse. So the common things that patients would actually present with would be low back pain or neck pain, but the actual conditions themselves, you can divide them to where children can have deformities of the spine. We call that scoliosis usually. And then we treat things like infection of the spine, different types, but the most common in South Africa being TB. And then we also treat things like cancer of the spine. So that can be cancer originating in the spine or cancer having spread to the spine.
Can you just expand on TB in the spine? I always associated with lungs.
No, I actually did a talk on TB, but let me, I'll just, a quick summary is TB can spread to the spine via, I'm trying to keep it as basic as possible, hematological spread, which is blood. So you could have had the focus maybe in the lungs, but it goes mainly and present in the spine. So those patients then present with either back pain or upper back pain, because it involves the part of the spine that is behind the chest called the thoracic spine. But it can involve the neck and the lower part of the spine. And then they can also present with deformity, whereby the spine is slowly falling forward, or they can present with paralysis, either of the arms or the legs or both. But usually the TB will be very slow and progressive when the patients do present. So it is South Africa, the second or third highest with TB of the spine, India taking number one in the world.
Well, I promise you, I learn something new every time I have a conversation.
Yes, we actually have very high high numbers with regards to that, but we know how to treat that. So for us, it's patients knowing when to present and how early they can present, because it's still treatable if not a major part of the spine is involved. So we would treat, is it just the nerve? Is it a back pain? Is it the spine itself? And that determines what happens to a patient, but the treatment, the medication is still key. Okay. Sorry, I touched on tumor of the spines, as well as the common things we treat is arthritis of the spine. So that being of the neck, of the thoracic spine, of the lumbar spine. So all the older patients, that's what they will present with. And then looking at the middle age, talking about late 20s, 40s, we talk about things like mechanical back pain or mechanical neck pain, as well as discs. A disc that can prolapse. That means maybe you lifted a TV, you were helping a friend, your muscles and your posture were not in the right position, and then you pop what we call a disc, which is a cushion that sits between the bones in the spine. And that is very common in the younger population. And trauma, that being anyone in a car accident, in jumping from a height, sports, any form of trauma where you hurt the spine, most spine surgeons also do cover that. So it's actually a very wide range of pathologies that we cover as spine surgeons.
And our spine is an essential piece of infrastructure.
Very. Your muscle balance, skeletal balance, your biokinetics of allowing you to walk, it's the spine. Allowing you to sit, it's the spine. Lifting things, it's actually a whole field just looking at spine. And my passion is actually spine agronomics, so which is becoming very topical currently, because we do a lot of things that affect the spine. And I think with things like COVID having happened, a lot of people now are working from home or are working in incorrect positions or posture, the wrong furniture. So I am finding younger and younger patients because of things like that. And then I find that I look at a lot of elderly patients who are now living longer and longer, and they are presenting now with degeneration of the spine.
You must have seen an array of different cases in your experience. Can you tell us about a couple of successes that stand out for you?
I have to mention one of the first cases that I actually treated as a spine surgeon in private practice, where a young girl was involved in a car accident, 15-year-old, and presented with what we call paraparesis. So she's not fully paralyzed, but the muscles and the nerves are involved. So she couldn't walk or move, but there was some residual movement still left. So the spine had dislocated. That means that one part of the spine moved forward against the other. So the spinal cord was actually trapped. And you know how young kids will be, 15-year-old jumped out the window at home, mom thinks she's sleeping, went to a party, and this is what you wake up to.
Gosh.
So it was harrowing for the patient point of view and the mother, but the success story, that being I was able to fix her. And it took quite a bit of rehabilitation, which is also very important in spine, because you can be the best spine surgeon, but if your patient is not properly rehabilitated, those results can end up not being fruitful. So after quite extensive rehabilitation, we were able to get her walking. So that for me is one of those very touching stories, and we don't control those kind of outcomes when it comes to trauma. But then we look at the opposite spectrum, where I treated just last year an 87-year-old, my oldest patient that I've operated on, having obviously tried, as you said, medication didn't work, bracing didn't work. Then we did what we call facet blocks. She wasn't getting better. And there's an active 87-year-old. For me, the lesson being that I don't think it's fair for people when they see the elderly or the geriatrics, they look at the number and then say, this is the end. You're too old for surgery. You're too old for any intervention. Like, just sit at home and wait and die. I take elderly patients very personal, because it's about looking about at them holistically. What's the physiology? Yvonne, she's very fit. She was actually fitter than half my patients. And it worked out well. She had her operation where she could hardly walk and walking with a stick. Now she's walking without one. And she was able to go and visit her children in Japan, her great-grandchildren in Japan. So that's the opposite spectrum, where now I'm talking about a very old lady versus the youngster who was involved in a car accident. So it's quite a spectrum of cases I get to see.
Fantastic in terms of restoring quality of life, irrespective of how old you are, and potentially as a patient feeling like you're in a very dire situation, and then having someone like you come in as a spine surgeon, putting in those corrective measures and rejuvenating their life.
Yes, it's very important for me to look at them holistically, not to prejudge based on the age. What is their function? What is their expected outcomes? What can I do for them? What has been done? Because you also must not have a God complex whereby you think I can fix and be all. I am very straight and honest and open with my patients with regards to what are my limitations, what I can do. And I'm very open door policy about them getting a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth opinion, because I say, maybe I'm only seeing this problem from this point of view. Another spine surgeon might think of something else, but this is what I can offer you, and this is how far I can go. That is how I like to look at my patients. Yeah,
it's a very mature approach and speaks of not being insecure.
Thank you. I try.
A few weeks ago, we hosted Dr. Marie Thiart, and in that conversation, I learned that there are only 5% of the orthopedic surgeon population in South Africa that are women. So I wanted to ask you, Given that this is such a male-dominated field, what attracted you to orthopedic spine surgery as an area of specialization compared to all the other choices?
Oh, thanks for that question, Dr. Amelia. For the spine surgery part, it's twofold. It was actually the spine itself. So when we are specializing just to be orthopedic surgeons, you become a general orthopedic surgeon. So you get to see the different parts of the body. So you can work either with kids, or you can work with hands, or you can work with hips and knees. So when I did my rotation in spine, I just saw that spine pulsating to the heart, and you just have to have reverence for it to know, as you say, it is kind of like part of the life source, because people think of brain and heart, obviously. Following those, I just feel that you have to revere how much you get to do because of the spine. And for me, I was inspired knowing that I can move someone who could hardly walk to walking, or someone who their spine is so bent over, they can't walk without a stick, or they can't look up, they can't sit, and make this person functional and back to, capacity. So that for me was number one. The second thing was looking at the country. At the time when I then decided to do the specialization, there were no other females who were already spine surgeons from orthopedics. So I must differentiate, because people always think spine surgeons are neurosurgeons only. Spine surgeons are twofold. You can have neurosurgeons, and those already did exist, so who are then females, and then you also have orthopedic surgeons who then specialize in spine. So at that time, there wasn't anyone who was holding the torch to say, follow after me, you guys can also do this. So I looked, and it was only males doing it. And I just found it a challenge that, one, this should be something that I, as a female, should be able to do. Gender shouldn't equate what I can or cannot do. And then, secondly, if I can do this, I can then pave the way for other females to then follow. So that for me was the driving force for the spine part. Yeah.
And in paving that way, how have you seen the landscape for orthopedic spine surgeon females evolved, and for women to enter the field more easily and excel in what they're doing?
Honestly speaking, Dr. Amelia, I haven't seen the effects yet. Believe it or not, it's 10 years later, well, 11. I did an AO Spine Fellowship, which is an internationally recognized fellowship based in Cape Town. Cape Town being one of the only centers in the Southern Hemisphere. It's Cape Town and East Africa. Those are the two. And then the rest are in Europe as well as North America. So in their records, I was the first and only female who's ever done it for the past 10 years. So last year, there was a lady who was then accepted into the program, but she's based in France. So she came, she's done the fellowship, now she's left with those skills. So I do go to conferences, I do present, I do have registrars that I mentor. So word is out there and getting out, which is part of why I like platforms like these to set that example that, listen, guys, females can do this as well. I'm one of them. And it doesn't leave me with pleasure to know that I'm the only one. Then what is the point? It can't take 10 years and nobody else then is following in that limelight. Maybe there are some who are learning one-on-one with specific surgeons. I'm talking now someone who's fellowship trained that I am not aware of from the AO Spine Fellowship. At that time when I did my fellowship, there was another lady, Dr. Ramushu, who was also training and had just finished. So she was one of them. After her, I'm not sure, because I was based at University of Pretoria. I don't think even more than four or five, which is, it's sad. It really is. So I'm hoping to inspire more females in my own department. There is one who looks interested. So I hope, this field will be joined and there will be a whole bunch of us soon. Yeah.
Let's keep up with the encouragement. On that note, what strategies could you recommend for encouraging more women to pursue careers in orthopedic spine surgery?
I think, as I said, platforms like these are important because it's about demystifying the whole concept of spine. Because when we are all training, especially for, doing the orthopedics training, is spine was so mystical, only the boffins did it, or only the top of the range. And it's not really true. If you have someone who can teach you and lead you through it as a one-on-one, you can see that, you know what, this is something else about acquiring the skill, acquiring the understanding, acquiring the network of having mentorship, because it is true that complications in spine can be dire. Hence, you must have reverence for that. So, if we can try and work more on that, I think we'd have more success with regards to that. So within the network of ladies that I have helped teach at the registrar level, once I came back, at least I was allowing them to do more, see more, because as an assistant at a registrar level, you might not even get to see why are they putting the screw, where are they putting the screw. So those kind of things that we've changed upon having now access to cadavers, because that was the thing. Before COVID, we could hardly get any cadavers for people to then work on. Post-COVID, there's been so many bodies that are not claimed by families and things like that. People now are more open to saying, you know what, I want to leave something or a legacy. If my family doesn't want to claim me, please feel free to give me to science. And that has allowed us to make better surgeons, not just in spine. I'm just using it as an example for spine, as in spine surgeon, arthroplasty surgeons, feet, shoulders. All these registrars then get to have a more realistic one-on-one working on a cadaver than to have to learn about that specialty when they see the patients for the first time. So I think that also will cultivate a culture of passion, and not just passion, knowledge about what you want to then do, because we spend more than 60 to 80% of our time at work. So you need to be passionate and really driven in what you do. That is my belief. Yeah. So for spine, you have to do that because these are very long, complex operations. And it just needs dedication and the women to know that you can do it. You can be a spine surgeon and be a wife and be a mother and be a mentor and be a teacher, but you need a village to help support you doing that, which is different from our male counterparts who then get to be that, but someone else is being the mom, the dad, the everything else that the woman is expected to be. And that is our reality.
You are all of those things. You are proof of success, that you can have a career, that you can mentor, that you can feed back into your discipline and still have a family life. So, as living proof, tell us how you do that.
Dr. Amelia, as I was touching on, it really is about the network of people who surround me. One, starting just career-wise, having done the fellowship, I still kept in touch with my mentors, because then as I get cases, there are cases you can read up on. There are cases where only experience will really, you know, teach you and make you a better surgeon. So I still have those one-on-one discussions. I'll phone up one of the profs and be like, listen, this is a case I've got. I'm thinking of doing this, then that. What are you thinking from your experience? How can I do it quicker without endangering the patient? Or how can I do less, especially the elder patient? You want to go in and out. You're not going to do an 8-hour op if I can do a 3-hour op. So these are the discussions then I have with them. So you must have that mentorship. Secondly, then you obviously have to have these kind of discussions with your partner, husband, whatever, prior to taking something like a spine fellowship, because usually it's grueling, it's long hours. So if you have that understanding, there's less than demands on you, because that person understands that if my wife says they have a spine op, I am not going to see them before 4 o'clock, or I'm not going to see them before whatever. So an understanding relationship is very important. Then I have the family structure. So knowing that I might have to travel, I have to do presentations, I have to do mentoring, knowing that there are people to help you either at home or either help you wherever you need that support. That's what I mean about the actual village. And then the actual work itself, where is it that you are working, your patients, the people that you work with in the hospital? So it can never be you are singular, I am the surgeon, and that's the end of it. I have a support system, my biokineticist, my physio, my physician, my whole team that I work with, whereby I can have seen a patient and then maybe I miss something after the op. Then the physio will call me and be like, are you aware that leg is a bit weaker than it looks? Then I'm open to those kind of discussions where we work as a team. I'm like, I've examined, but okay, maybe I missed something. Go back and see. There are some things maybe a patient might say to one of the team members that they haven't said to me. So it is all possible, but you have to have all these structures in place. And then the mentoring part is not always easy, is getting registrars who can be aligned to who and how you work. But you never know that until you are given that registrar. But at least setting those boundaries and expectations, which I have done, it's not always delivered on, but at least they know what I expect. That if I say once a month, I want a feedback about how far you are with your research, or by February, I want this done and that and that. So it helps you then balance all those different aspects of your life.
So it's a combination of organization, social constructs, as well as I would almost say culture, and culture being home and culture being work, and this view of a holistic view that's shared by everyone in your network of what you have to do, what they have to do in order to keep the system running, the engine on.
Yes, that's very true. I like how you put it. I actually never thought about it like that. And obviously, I also have to deliver from my part, whereby, sorry, I left out where the mothering part. You are going to feel guilty that there are times where you have very long days and nights because our operations do take a long time. Then you have to sit down and introspect. If I had two or three late nights, then the weekend becomes where I am a present mother. I am not on the phone or on my computer. Then I know Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I am their best friend. I am the hockey player when they want to play hockey. I am all those things to then make up. Because if we as women don't have these discussions, then we have unrealistic expectations of what you can deliver. It's not possible. You can't be everywhere and everything to everybody, but it's about trying to balance when I lack at this part, where and how will I make it up? And that's what I've tried to institute within my life, and having those essential me times where you have to reflect that maybe they I'm slacking a bit, or having open relationships with the people around you who then tell you, listen, I have those kind of conversations with my husband, and like, you've dropped the ball a bit there at being mommy this week. Then I'm like, you know what? Thanks. I might have forgotten that. I'll pick it up next week and make it up. These next 3 days, I'm not doing any ops. Do you understand? So you need to have those kind of conversations.
That's also such a great approach, that it's a learning experience, that I'll do better next time. And we just keep the positivity and flow.
It's very, very, very important, Dr. Amelia, because having to work in a very male-dominated field, not necessarily because it comes from males, I think we end up in general maybe being within toxic environments. That's why I don't want to say it as an, I don't think it's a gender thing. It could be, it's just, I've never worked in a female just based environment. So I don't have that comparison, but my toxicity would be that us as females, we tend to take on the role of being more masculine. And then you then lose that femininity, and it's very then easy to drop all these other balls of what you are expected. That's where that introspection then comes in, that, listen, I'm not having me time. I'm not having mommy time. I'm not having this time and whatever. You want to now be and act like your counterparts who are not you. We will never be. That's why I was able to say before, when I was acting head in where I was working prior, where if my daughter is sick, it is different to when my colleague's daughter is sick. My colleague who is married has a wife who might be staying at home, who can then take care of the child or take the child to the doctor and phone him and say, our daughter is sick. And he can say, do this, do that, do that. If my daughter is sick, I am the mother. But at the same time, I'm sitting here, I am heading this department. Now comes the whole conundrum of how sick is she? I need to leave this. This part of being acting head now has to be switched off. I am now a mother, which is a priority to me, and I have to leave, but then have accountability. Can this one cover this work that I was supposed to do? Can this one make sure this and that and that and that is done? It can't be that you now become an emotive female who's like, my child is sick and that's the end. You still have responsibilities. Make sure all those things are covered. And then I say, guys, unfortunately, now I am mother role. I have to take over this part. And then you do and do that. And it's just understanding and having that maturity to see that how can you juggle all these balls? And unfortunately, you will drop some balls. Mm-hmm. And that's the reality of it.
In our conversation, one of the things that I've really picked up from is the significant role of teams in your environment. And that if something happens to a member of the team, be that family issue, be it a work issue, that someone else in the team will be able to pick up. So there is accountability, the job gets done, and everybody takes responsibility in that team environment.
Yes, it's true. That's what makes me the success that I am. If I then acted like it is because of just only my accomplishments and this is how I got here, I would then be lying and setting the bar way higher than it should be. But I am able to do the things I do because of these multi-units that surround me, and then they make everything flow very well. And communication is key, because it's not always easy sometimes to hear, listen, you are slacking in this part. Or, you know, how do you now reflect to see that, you know what, I'm becoming more masculine than I should be female, or I am, you know, going way beyond what I need to when it then comes to the patient's need, the patient's life, and then I am forgetting who I am and centering my life around me as well. So it's about finding that balance. It's not easy. It's work in progress. I haven't fully arrived. I feel I could even be better, but work in progress.
You've given us some real truisms there and reality check on insights and how to manage things, but also recognizing that balls will be dropped and it's part of being human.
Yes, thank you. Let's try and pick them up. It's about the picking them up and seeing how do I not drop it next time.
Yeah. You are very actively involved in your field, as we've already discussed, being a member of various organizations. You publish, you present, you give lectures, you train, and you teach medical students as well as orthopedic registrars. And you also serve as an examiner and a moderator. What would you say motivates you to be so deeply involved in various aspects of your field?
I think my drive is education. For me, learning and having knowledge for myself, it doesn't seem right, it doesn't fit right, it doesn't feel right. It's something that I think I took from my grandmother and my own mother, whereby I've always had something whereby if we have a skill, it must then be passed on or it must be used to embetter someone else. So I've always loved teaching. But remember, you can love something and not be good at it. I'm not sure about that, but hey, at least I still try. That's what I will say about that. So that's where the student part comes in. And for me, the drive being, I always say that, fine, you have these skills. And if these skills aren't passed on, what good is that? Because these are the same people who will then, when we are geriatrics, need to have the skills to take care of us. And think most people are then, we're just a bit short-sighted about where we've got pitfalls, by empowering the next generation, we then make sure that we are taken care of better, but then they can pass on their skills and even better themselves. So education of students is key by giving them basics, and then they have something to build on. Okay. And not just giving them the basics, it's you enlighten them so that they can see there is so much that there is to know and make them safe doctors. My students will tell you that's a one and first thing I always say. I was like, I don't care about your exams. Yes, obviously you care because you are here and you want to get the degree. I care that when you go out there and you said you passed me or you we crossed paths, I made you better to be a safer doctor, because there's so much trust that is given to doctors by patients out there. And yet not everybody has the skill or capability to actually treat those patients. So as an orthopedic surgeon, I must make sure they know what's urgent, they know what's important, they know what's life-saving, and then the rest they build onto that skeleton. Then when it comes to the registrar, so I'm dividing them into groups, it then becomes that they are good specialists, know what you can do, how much you can change people's lives, and if not, when to refer, and not to just hold on to patients, because it's unfortunately part of the culture, which is actually not good. And then also build up that passion about, for us to get better, there's academia. Academia being the passing on the skill and then the publishing and the research. So not everybody has that need and light or want to really publish and look at articles and things like that. So if you can find one or two, for me, it's enough that, okay, this skill then will be passed on, because people forget, for innovation to occur, someone must look back. So by that's for me is my light of what's next. What can I do better so that this skill is then passed on?
Such a sustainable approach, and this combination of imparting not just the hard skills, but the soft skills, which are probably harder to acquire and implement.
It's work in progress. It's not always easy, because human nature is that you want people to be aligned to who you are and how you are. And it's not always easy to make that puzzle fit. So I'm also a work in progress.
Dr. Pomela, you've shared some insights into yourself throughout this conversation, and aspects that make you tick, aspects which help you keep everything together. Reflecting on the past, can you share a few of your pivotal moments in life growing up?
Oh, wow. I can do that. For me, it was having a conversation with my grandmother, whereby she was relating how she used to have to walk my mom when she was young 20 kilometers to get to a school so that she could be educated. So I wouldn't be where I am without my mother and father. So had that initiative not been there, that distance wasn't anything that could hinder her to make sure her child has a better life by being educated, who am I not to do more for myself, for my nuclear family, and for others? And from that, prior to her dying, she made sure that a school was established less than 500 meters from her house, so that the kids in the village did not have to walk 20 kilometers one direction. There's not a fallacy, it's Collie Wobbles, and the village is called Mangati, so you can Google that. You see, it's the only school besides this one, and it's a 20-kilometer distance for one little child to go. So for me, that's where the love of education comes in and empowering, because now kids have no option but to go to school because they've got one less than 500 meters.
What a legacy. Fantastic. Yes.
So those are kind of pivotal points that I've had. And then so that it's not all roses, I always try to share this story as well, is when I didn't actually make it into medicine. So that people know it's just because your path is not smooth doesn't mean that the dream that you are supposed to live or aspire to, you know, it's the end of it. It just means that you're just taking a detour and you might be getting empowered for later on. So in matric, my marks weren't good enough for medicine, which was my first choice. Second choice then was a BSc. And I ended up then getting to Rhodes University to do my BSc in biochemistry and chemistry as well. So I did that. And I'm not a starter of things and then leave it. I did the full BSc where many people ask, why didn't you just do the 1 year and then apply to medicine? I'd committed to a degree. I finished that degree. So you can say 3 years of my life was wasted, but I say 3 years of my life was enriched because I now understood biochemistry and microbiology, which is my other major, much better when I was then doing medicine. So for me, I believe that it's better even for my patient. I know my drugs better. It just improved my life. And there are friendships that were established there that have really helped sustain me when I had to then specialize. So that's one of the other pivotal points. And then when I got to be in the AO Spine Fellowship as the first female to do it, I take pride in that, in because I said that to me, it was being a trailblazer whereby I had no one to look up to, but I saw this and I was like, why can I not do this so that others can see that all things are possible? Why not? And then again, sorry, I'm a lady of many firsts, but when I got to do the SAO, so South African Orthopedic Association and German Fellowship. So I got to go across to Germany for a month presenting at more than 10 cities, 10 universities, my research that we had done in South Africa on, again, my topics are always spine. So it was TB of the spine and looking at the spectrometer that we use, a spec scan, and how it would find areas where the patient might have early TB prior to seeing them. And second research was on children who had very severe spinal deformities, unable to sit and things like that. So those have been very pivotal career-wise. Obviously, there's personal, but it was for the career things. Yeah.
Wow.
And then to be the first female acting head in orthopedics. So yeah, that was a lot. That was a lot that has geared my career the way that it is. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing those moments with us. And the way you're talking, I think there's more to come.
I hope so. There's a few projects I want to work at, but yeah, you will be updated.
As we close out today's conversation, please can you use this platform to share a few words of motivation with girls and women who are listening to us on the continent?
I believe that gender is not an equalizer or determiner of what your future should be. And my scripture is, I can do all things through Christ Jesus. I know not everybody is a Christian, but for me, it's something I've held dear from when I was young. So you will have challenges because of who you are, of what you are, of what gender you are, what color you are, but I hold that true to myself that no matter what obstacle is in my way, if I can just remember that if I want it, it is possible. If I have a passion for it, it is possible. If I have a drive for it, it is possible. The rest is just relying on structures and units around you to do that. So do not limit who you are and what you can do because of what society tells you. It must be, I don't want to do this because the love of this is gone. I don't want to do this because the drive is gone. But never let another person be the one to tell you that you can only climb the ceiling this far and you cannot break that ceiling. Break it. Who knows what's on the other side? So my school alma mater was Super Astro Sparrow. I went to Treverton College, and that means reach beyond the stars. And I live by that.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to host you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Amelia.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Dr. Lusanda Bomela, who is an orthopedic spine surgeon with a practice in Johannesburg.